You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Scabies and gentlemen, boils and ghouls, fiends from beyond the binary. You're listening to a very special episode of the Toll of Hell Radio Show. I'm Joe Thrashenkill. With me, I've got my co-host, Jordan, the Golden Boy. How's it going, Jordan?
I am actually terrified right now because I am just naturally assuming that you are a ghost or some sort of undead zombie, because I would have assumed by now you would have cut your own heart out and donated it to Bernie Sanders.
I don't need to. That dude is as strong as like 10 other old dudes. You know, we talk about like old man strength. That guy could split a board in half with his dick. Yeah. Like, he's fine.
Well, I can't well, wait didn't, for the didn't video he's... of him like dunking on some kids and like some basketball, you know.
Yeah.
didn't he split his head open on a shower door?
Yeah, that happens though. People do that. Anyway, the other voice you're hearing is our very special guest for this episode. Please welcome to the show Brittany, who I do not know.
Yeah, no, not at all. I think for my special name, I'll be Banshee Brittany.
Banshee Brittany? Okay.
There's something, you know, endearing about a screeching woman, especially when it comes to October, so.
Well, you gotta have the Twitter name updated for Halloween, which is something I can't do, so you might as well do it for me.
Oh, you should be 666 Days of Horror.
Just like Valentine's Day reference or something sweet and nice for the month of October. When people go through their, ooh, I watched 31 straight days of horror movies. I'm just like, pff, pff, whoa, a whole month. Wow, how do you do it?
I'm going to have big white bitch energy and just watch all the Hallmark Christmas movies during October and just open a Lovecraftian portal that way.
It's going to be the eHarmony movie. You have to watch that one first. Or Christian Mingle. That's what it was. Christian Mingle has a movie.
Didn't they come out? Oh, my God.
Our former editor, W, told me that he watched that one with his wife.
Did it bring their relationship closer together?
I think that he's just they're very accepting of each other's quirks, which is key to a relationship, I guess. On one hand, you have a lady that likes, you know, the Christian white lady movies, and on the other hand, you have a guy that's spent his entire life listening to noise.
And watching Godzilla movies.
But those are fantastic. That's the good stuff. Now, I'm waiting on, like, the farmermeat.com movie to come out.
Oh, Farmers Only.
Farmers Only, yeah. So I can get my fill of, like, cute farm animals and then some Christianity thrown in there.
See, I'm assuming that the take on that movie would be, like, the new Antifa movie that's coming out. It's like, Farmers Only! Libs, get out!
In a world where there are only farmers, one man must find love.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd probably watch that.
Well, yeah.
That'll be our next crossover with I Hope You Suffer. keeping in theme with this month and our stated goal of watching a very, very good horror movie each week, I decided that we would talk about one today that is very underappreciated, I think. I'd say in the grand scheme of the horror oeuvre, this one gets criminally overlooked, even though it has a lot of things going for it, like being created by John Carpenter, mm-hmm. that man that we all know and love.
And having the endlessly pleasing Sam Neill, who, speaking of farmers, like, chose to retire on a farm with wine and pigs and just lives his best life now.
And just grows wine and has pigs.
Yeah. So this is, In the Mouth of Madness is part of the informal trilogy around The Thing and Prince of Darkness, which we all know and love The Thing. Have you seen Prince of Darkness, Jordan?
I own it.
Nice. Oh. I don't know that I've seen that one.
You haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
Not that I know you, but... so Prince of Darkness, I love that it's from that time period in horror where it's like, we don't know how science works, so we're just going to approximate what we think physics is and then pair that with, like, the devil.
Checks out.
Yeah.
Physics is the devil. Yeah, In the Mouth of Madness came out in 1995. That would put it 24 years ago. Jordan, that era of horror, the mid-90s, this is just one man's perspective, but it seems like that was a pretty dead spot for things that we would consider maybe long-lasting, worth a watch 25 years later.
I think it was like a hangover from the 80s, kind of like the golden age of horror, and a lot of slashers and that sort of thing. You had your Friday the 13th and all these other big franchises that by the mid-90s are already in like part 5, part 6.
You already had your leprechauns going to space.
Yeah.
After they'd been to the hood.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why go anywhere else after you've been to the hood? That's the best one. But I think in this era, too, there's kind of just a shift in horror where like a lot of big studios like tried to get in on it, but still wanted the movies to be appealing to more people. So you got a lot of like wishy-washy horror movies, and it didn't really come out of it until like the late 90s, like teen horror movie craze kind of pulled it out from the mid-90s malaise.
You're talking about like the I Know What You Did Last Summers and such?
Yeah, while they're not like the best horror movies, I think they did well enough to kind of snap people out of just kind of these horror movies that went on during the era.
Well, yeah, when I think about notable horror movies released around the mid-90s, I'm thinking about things like Jack Frost, the anthropomorphic snowman murderer movie that sucks major ass. Did you ever see that one, Jordan?
Yep, I've seen it.
Yeah,
that's more of a comedy, anyway.
That's fair.
Yeah, I'd say it's better than, what, the Michael Keaton version?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The real horror movie.
The real horror.
I can't keep those two separate in my mind. I just imagine Michael Keaton is murdering his family in that movie.
Oh, that'd be a much better version. Like, Shining meets Jack Frost. Well, but at the same time, like, you had Event Horizon in the 90s.
Event Horizon, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that ties in very neatly with Sam Neill, and that... Man, back-to-back on that one, just killing the horror game. Such a great leading actor for this.
Because I think that's what I miss so much about horror, you know, prior to Ari Aster kind of revitalizing that as well, and like the smaller, more independent horror films, is you see a lot of major actors and actresses get their start in horror. Like, speaking of Leprechaun...
Jennifer Aniston.
That was, like, her first movie where she got really discovered.
You had Tremors with... who's the fucking guy
Kevin
in Tremors?
Kevin Bacon. Yeah.
He might have gotten his start in Footloose, though. I'm wrong. Never mind. Yeah. Don't pay attention to me.
But, point being, like, you know, Sam Neill is such a great actor, and he brings this, like, sincerity and, like, gravity to any role he has. And so when you have him in something like Event Horizon and In the Mouth of Madness, it just drives everything home where you can feel his fear and you can feel like him losing his mind.
He goes full on insane in both of those movies. It's very good. What are your overall impressions of In the Mouth of Madness, Jordan?
I think that this is one of the best representations of a Lovecraftian horror movie that has nothing to do with Lovecraft.
Yeah. I don't know that it's possible to do it any better aside from maybe The Void.
Oh, which is also fantastic.
But, and again, The Void felt like more like an homage to Hellraiser than to Lovecraft necessarily.
And I was reading about this prior to us, you know, jumping on, but they lifted some lines directly from Lovecraft's works and put them into In the Mouth of Madness. So there's one scene where she's reading from, you know, this book that is driving everyone crazy, and the line that she has is pulled directly from a work of Lovecraft. So going through it, I kind of felt like it was a guilt-free Lovecraft experience where, like, you didn't have... You know, the N-word, like, ever-present in the back of your brain from this racist...
The fear of seeing a Turkish man.
An Esquimo.
Yeah. So you also gave me this little tidbit before going in that I guess we should give a little bit of a backstory on this. I don't think it's possible to spoil this movie, really. Unlike with the one that we did last week with Audition, which has plot points that, you know... are really pretty jarring. This one, I think you can understand, like, ancient horror, man loses his mind. And also, it's fucking 25 years old, so get over it. Watch the movie, then come back to us if you haven't seen it already. That the the main plot point driving this story forward is the existence of a billion-selling horror author named Sutter Kane. There are a couple of sly references in the script. Like, oh, Stephen King ate shit. Sutter Kane's where it's at. Now, what were you reading, Brittany, before this?
So, yeah, I mean, John Carpenter and Stephen King are friends. You know, they've collaborated over the years on so many projects. And he essentially made this movie, like, a direct jab at Stephen King, just to kind of consistently be like, you ain't shit, like, while he's going through this whole process. So yeah, he bases the character of Sutter Kane on Lovecraft, of course, but in the concept that his work is much better and more widely read and sold than Stephen King's.
When we watched this yesterday, were you wearing your Stephen King Rules shirt?
I was. Yeah, yeah. I really want a Sutter Kane Rules shirt.
So is it Stephen King, like, he rules, or is it like, these are the rules for reading Stephen King?
Rule number one. Have you seen Monster Squad?
I actually just watched it again this week.
Fuck yes. Okay, I love that. One of my favorite movies. But, like, you know, one of the kids wears his Stephen King Rules shirt? Yeah. I saw somebody out, like, a couple years ago, and they had Sutter Kane Rules. And I was like, oh, that's fantastic. Like, what a good crossover.
A double reference.
Yeah.
Only real horror nerds get this shit.
Yeah.
Name three of their novels.
I really want to be a gatekeeper for horror nerd shit, since I can't be that for metal, so...
Yeah. We're going to have Robin on eventually, and you two can collaborate on that, being the lady horror gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm. So we cut you off, Jordan. I apologize. Going into this, yeah, on a second watch, like, did anything stand up especially well for you, or was it also pretty good?
I mean, I still enjoy it. It's a really good horror movie, pretty much start to finish. What I think works with the movie is we're on the same journey as Sam Neill's character.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Starting from the beginning, like, you just don't know what's going on. And it's not where some of these movies where it's supposed to be a mind fuck, where things get switched all around. It's a slow descent into madness where... Like, you're as skeptical as he is starting. This guy doesn't have any sort of powers. This is just weird coincidences. And then it kind of gets further and further. Like, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is where Sam Neill is on a bus and he falls asleep and Sutter Kane shows up next to him. And right before Sam Neill's character wakes up, he says, "Did I ever tell you my favorite color is blue?" When he wakes up, everything's like a weird bluish tint.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whenever I actually, like, wake up early in the morning and I see it's kind of that weird blue light, I think of that scene.
This is Sutter Kane's world and we're all just living in it.
Yeah, it's great because he reacts with like, genuine terror, freaks out all the old ladies on the buses.
But should we give a brief rundown before we continue further?
Let's give a brief rundown. We keep saying Sam Neill, Sam Neill this, Sam Neill that. Everybody can't quit talking about Sam Neill. He's America's sweetheart. He's not American, is he?
No, he's New Zealand.
Ah, Kiwi.
Or he's from New Zealand. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Sam Neill plays John Trent, a hyper-rational skeptic that makes his living investigating fraudulent insurance claims, which, to be honest, seems like a pretty fun job. He's, you know, earlier in the movie, we see him grilling a ham-faced man in a 100-degree room. He's just boiling hot with sweat while lying to Sam Neill. And just he really appreciates unpacking people's lies and
he's very rational. He's a very Jordan Peterson-esque man without any of the things that make that terrible.
I guess before that, though, we open with him in a slightly different state, though, right?
Yes. So what I love about this movie, well, one of the things I love about this movie is it's told in a flashback, but it's not done in a way that is really obnoxious. And it actually keeps the train of events to where, like, everything clicks. And like you said, it's a very slow descent into madness. But the movie definitely starts with him being committed to an insane asylum. And he's just, I mean, completely insane. And so it's really jarring to see that side of him. And then when he starts telling his story to the psychiatrist who's in to visit him, to view just how different a man he was a very short time ago.
See, what's interesting is that he's not well, but I wouldn't say he's totally insane either. Because when he's talking to the psychologist, which one is it?
psychiatrist.
Just shrink. He says, so you want to know who my they is? He's like, what are you talking about? It's like, well, every paranoid schizophrenic has a they or a them or an it. You want to hear about mine.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, he's still with it.
Yeah, and so once we kind of get this flashback started, we see him pulled in by this big publishing company, and they want to hire him to find Sutter Kane, their preeminent selling horror writer who's gone missing. And not only is he missing, but the final book that he was supposed to be working on is missing as well.
This is the, who's the J.R.R., not
Tolkien?
Not Tolkien. That's the G.R.R. Yeah. Martin. He's the George Martin of the era, in mm-hmm. that you'll never see that book. It's gone to the the land of the land of horror.
he's of course skeptical. He thinks this is a publicity stunt. Compounding this is the fact that people who read Sutter Kane are supposed to show signs of insanity and schizophrenia and become erratic and violent. And prior to him being pulled in, he's actually attacked in a cafe by a man who tries to kill him with an axe. And right before he swings it, he says, you know, do you read Sutter Kane?
Do you read Sutter Kane?
And then in a very real moment of police brutality, he's shot by the cops.
Yeah, the most fantastical part of this is that the cops put like 19 bullets into him and didn't hit a single bystander that was running behind him. Put aside your skepticism for one moment.
For one moment.
We'll enjoy the story.
But so he decides, you know, to kind of investigate the Sutter Kane mythos to find out where he could have gone. And he's looking for clues in the manuscripts that he's already published. And interspersed with this journey are, like, you know, different visions that he's having the more that he reads Sutter Kane's work. And over time, he realizes that if he takes the covers of the books off and lines them up in a grid, it actually forms the state of, I believe, Delaware?
New Hampshire. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that could be seen as another veiled shot towards Stephen King, who sets everything in Maine, which is right next door.
Well, exactly. Where was Lovecraft based out of? Is that Rhode Island, right?
Rhode Island, yep.
Yeah. I guess he couldn't make a distinctive shape out of the books for Rhode Island.
That'd actually be really good. Yeah, but like you said, it's a direct shot at Stephen King, who somehow made Maine the spookiest fucking place to ever exist.
Yeah, I mean, Maine, yeah. It's a terrifying place. Yeah, yeah, Jordan, what were your thoughts going into this, setting up the journey?
It's a nice journey. I think setting it in New England is a good move. There's a lot of, like, old horror-esque things about the area, just because it's so old and it's been settled for 300 years in some places. At least I know where my dad lives in upstate New York, there are some families that have been living in the area for over 200 years.
Christ.
She's like, oh, those are the Whites, those are the Yorks. And if you go back into, like, town history, they've been around forever, so it's kind of fitting with this awkward weirdness that it goes on from pretty much the start of the movie.
And I mean, y'all definitely have to have ghosts up there, right?
Yeah.
Like, you've got witch trials that happened, you've got, you know, God knows what else up there. So it's just a hodgepodge of spooky energy.
The ghosts are definitely exclusive to New England. It's not like we had a Trail of Tears down here or anything like that.
When you put it that way.
No, I think you just have to assume ghosts are everywhere. You know, people die. There are no ghosts in Antarctica, I'll tell you that. There might be, like,
penguin ghosts.
You know, something living under the ice, but it's not a ghost. It would be like a great old one, perhaps.
Oh, I was just thinking, like, an old bacteria that'll just wipe us out as soon as climate change gets there. Yeah, but
You might say that there's a thing. Oh.
An unnamed thing.
Let's call it Jerry. We get to go on our journey across New England to New Hampshire from New York. If you had to estimate, Jordan, how long is that drive?
Oh, 6 hours, maybe.
Okay. I enjoyed that this drive from New York City to New Hampshire to find the mythical town of Hobbs End, It took at least 40 days.
Yeah. Well, and watching it the first time, it didn't register to me because I live in Texas. And so to get anywhere, it's like 7 to 9 hours. So I was like, yeah, obviously they'd be driving for 2 days to get from one northeastern state to another. But apparently it's just part of the horror. But yes, so Hobbs End is the town that he thinks Setter Kane has gone to. It's not listed on any map. But his reasoning is, well, this place is full of old towns that have not been included on any modern maps, so it's got to be there. And actually, hob is a very old word for devil, like a medieval word, which strikes me as being very funny.
So the town is called Devil Butt?
Devil Butt.
Oh, come on, Devil Butt, huh?
Old Devil Tush.
Yeah, so it's a... You know, they're driving for a while. They can't seem to find it. And apparently it requires falling asleep, having a graphic hallucination. And then you can cross the old covered bridge from Beetlejuice to enter Hobbs End. What did you think about that scene on the highway there, Jordan?
Well, I think with the falling asleep and finding this place, you could surmise that he actually fell asleep in the car and died.
Certainly. That's also how Beetlejuice started.
Ooh. I was telling Joe, like, movies like this in Beetlejuice and, like, The Headless Horseman, you know, Legend of Sleepy Hollow, have just, for some reason, made me terrified of covered bridges. Like, especially the version that's in this movie, because I feel like nothing good ever comes of it. It's never a good time.
Yeah, do you ever encounter those in New England?
New England, upstate New York, yeah, they do exist.
Okay. Seems like we don't have that kind of shit here.
No.
Maybe not where we're going.
Yeah. he could be dead, or, you know, he could be transported into this Lovecraftian alternate universe, which is probably closer to the truth. But then again, who knows? We're still skeptic, right? Like, yeah. We're still set in reality, as they keep repeating. Like, reality is what you make it.
It's worth noting that he's sent out on this journey with Sutter Kane's editor, so he's not going solo. And his editor that actually drives the car into Hobbs End, she sees these horrific hallucinations while Sam Neill is sleeping like a fucking baby. And then she's freaking out when she realizes, like, oh, I made it through this dark, spooky tunnel, and now it's the middle of the day in this beautiful, idyllic, you know, city. Mm-hmm. And Sam Neill wakes up. He's like, ah, awesome, you know?
Yeah, in the course of them driving here, it's also worth noting she, like, hits a kid on a bike. Like, she hits him, you know, they screech to a halt. She drives back. They both get out. The kid is still there, like, they've hit this person on a bike, and he's now old and saying, like, he won't let me out, which is horrifying. That fits in with a horror movie. But then he gets up and rides away, and, like, Sam Neill's fine with it. She's obviously traumatized, and he's like, oh, he's probably fine. Like, we'll tell someone in the next town.
Yeah, I hit a child with my 3,000-pound Cadillac.
And then he just tells her to keep driving. Like, he doesn't even take over the car.
He's from New York. That happens like 3 or 4 times a day.
You're right. There's a great moment later on where he's like, you know, this is what happens when I leave the city, like when shit's hitting the fan. And it's so Seinfeld-esque that, like, yeah. But yeah, so.
So we enter Hobbs End, which, you know, it's Silent Hill, right? Like, it's.
Without the fog.
Exactly. Well, the graphics were much better, so they didn't need the fog. You can improve your draw distance.
Yeah, no spooky, yet also hot nurses either. There's a real lack of that. You just get...
the mother from Happy Gilmore?
Yes.
The grandmother, rather. Damn it. Who is that actress? She's in everything. Literally everything. She was the landlady in Kingpin.
Oh man, she was so great in that. Yeah, she was also the psychic in the Insidious movies.
She has made a career out of playing an insanely old woman. All right, Lee Trevino? Oh, you're looking at Happy Gilmore. When the fuck was Lee Trevino in this movie?
Francis Bay is her name. Yes. Francis Bay.
I got really excited about Miss Pro Golfer cameo and In the Mouth of Madness.
How did we miss this? They're going through this town. Everything lines up perfectly with Sutter Kane's stories. And then they go to this hotel run by Francis Bay, who again has been 95 for the last, you know, 70 years. And she checks them into a room. And at this point, the editor of Sutter Kane's books is just really spooked. She admits that, yes, this was supposed to be a publicity stunt, but they were never supposed to find anything. And Sutter Kane had gone missing prior to him showing up to kind of, like, kick off this whole bit. So she's spooked. He's still accusing it, you know, of being a hoax. And then they go to the Black Church.
Yeah, he gets up to their hotel room. He opens up the window and he says, you know, if this was actually the Hobbs Inn in Sutter Kane's novels, there would be a black church with golden onion spirals, and he's just looking at a barn. And his editor is like, no, dumbass, it's out this window. apparently, that is a real structure, a real town in Canada. They didn't go through the trouble of building an obsidian satanic church for this, which is... awesome. I want to see this church so bad.
Well, apparently the town they shot this in, it was also used in a couple of other movies pre-9/11. And I was trying to figure out why people aren't allowed to film there anymore. But, like, no film crews now are allowed to film in this town post-9/11. I should have dug into that deeper before coming on so I had an answer for it.
It's cursed!
It's cursed!
Have you seen this Obsidian Church before, Phil?
Before the movie?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Because it's so wild that exists and is out there, and I want to see it so bad.
I mean, you've seen mega churches. Is that really any weirder than this?
I guess not. It's actually... Okay, I found the name here because I fucked up and forgot. It's the Cathedral of the Transfiguration. And that's in Markham, Ontario. So, this shit looks evil as hell, man. Apparently it's just run-of-the-mill Catholicism, though. So, standard evil.
I do love the idea, though, of, like, when you said mega church, Jordan, of, like, one of these really modern horror movies that deal with, like, text messages or something, and they have to go to a church, but the only church they can find is, like, Joel Osteen's mega church in, like, Houston, and he won't let them in.
Yeah, there's...
The doors are locked.
Yeah.
It's raining. That's the end of the movie.
It's raining. Fuck off.
He hasn't been shamed enough on social media yet to take pity on people.
God, if I can have a brief aside, I remember my mom would watch Joel Osteen when he was fairly new on the scene, and before he, I guess, totally sold his soul out. But his whole thing, and it killed me, because every time that I watched him talk, he would say the same thing. You know me, I'm the smiling preacher, man. That's what people call me. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, you Christ. Are a child eater.
Your wife is bathing in the blood of children like the Countess of Bathory.
Absolutely.
I
lost my train of thought. I just kept thinking about Joel Osteen eating children.
I know, we could go down that path all day. Hooking us back. So yes, around this time you start to notice that the townspeople in Hobbs End just seem infected by something. They're infected by the madness coming out of this church. And it started with the children, because that's, you know, the creepiest move to make. And now it's spreading to the adults. And so it's really hard to kind of progress from here. Like, do you have a concise way of unfolding the madness that follows, Jordan?
Weird shit happens.
Beautiful.
It do be like that, though, because the rest of the movie becomes much harder to track narratively. You see, whereas, like, the hallucination sequences were a little bit more sparse in the beginning, they become much, much more frequent. And you're no longer really sure which reality you're following. You begin to doubt yourself, as our character Samuel does as well. There are some really fun, just little flashes of horror in this movie, and I'm not entirely sure if you know, the things are supposed to be so dark because they didn't have a lot of budget, or if they wanted to maintain some air of mystery so you're still not really sure what you're seeing.
I think it's a mix of both, because, like, do you remember there's a scene toward the end where shit has hit the fan. The whole town is degrading into chaos. You've got all these monsters coming out and people are mutating. The editor at this point has kind of succumbed to the madness as well. And you get this great shot of Lovecraftian creatures that have kind of come through the gate. And it's like a wall of them moving all at once. Do you remember this? They were going down the tunnel chasing Sam Neill as he tries to return to our world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a wave of scary coming at him.
Yeah,
like that was all, instead of that being individual creatures and like people in suits, that was a wall of like animatronic monsters that 30 people had to manage all at once and move on a lever. And so I think it was, yeah, a mix of both where you want the ambience, but then you've also got these practical effects that just maybe wouldn't look as great, you know, in full daylight.
Yeah. And it reminded me, we watched that documentary about Hellraiser where they were talking about the final demon in Hellraiser and how that was essentially like just this totally cumbersome thing that wasn't even fully built out, that you had a bunch of people moving, and it was so darkly shot because it was incomplete.
So very similar here. But yeah, so just to kind of get us to this point where we kind of wrap up that narrative, the hallucinations are increasing, shit is hitting the fan. And then we find out that Trent has a job that Sutter Kane is giving him. And Sutter Kane at this point is essentially God opening the door to these creatures that have been made real by people's belief in his writing. And he's become their mouthpiece. And so Trent's job is to take his final finished manuscript and take it back to the human world and just unleash this everywhere.
I would like to mention the undulating wooden door that hangs out next to Sutter Kane. It's just barely holding back all the demons. That shit's pretty tight. Sorry, what were you going to say, Jordan?
I was going to say that one of the scenes I liked when things are going bad is the old woman at the hotel. She has her husband chained up to her.
Yeah, that scene came on and I was like, oh, kinky. Because he's just naked, like, on the ground.
See, a naked old man ass. It's very flat.
We saw his Hobbs End. But yeah, so that's great, though, because when they first check into that hotel, he's like, well, if this is a Sutter Kane story, she's supposed to chop up her husband with an axe, and she's so sweet, she'd never do that. And so it's the self-fulfilling prophecy as you go through the movie, and then, you know, the sweet old lady is absolutely murderous.
Becomes like this horrific fucking snake demon that's just like slashing organs with an axe.
Yeah, and speaking of practical effects, that was originally supposed to be a person in a costume, and they couldn't make it look good enough, so that's actually a miniature.
Nice.
Yeah, and it looks great. Yeah. It looks fantastic.
It's worth noting, I believe, that the budget on this movie was around $14 million. Mm-hmm. So they got a lot done with that amount of money. Granted, it was, you know, 20 years ago, but still did a pretty good job creating an entire town and, you know, this black church and all of these insanely cool John Carpenter effects, like his editor becoming a version of the dog monster from The Thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ugh.
It made less than $8 million at the box office, so this would be considered a big-ass failure. I don't know if they ever made the money back on the back end. What do you think?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, they made a lot of love back. Like, it's a great movie that I think people have come to really appreciate over time, especially in, you know, today's environment where practical effects are kind of falling by the wayside. This is a great example of what you could accomplish with an okay budget and just a lot of creativity. Like, Greg Nicotero is the guy who was on set for this and, like, doing a lot of these effects.
An Italian, huh?
Jesus. Funnily enough, his foot got run over by the giant monster wall that took 30 people to operate, and they had to stop filming to take him to the hospital. But yeah, no, it's, you know, by the end of the movie, we realize that, I think what's great about this movie is that Sam Neill's character is doing everything he can to stave off the apocalypse, And at the end of the day, it's bigger than him. He is just a character that Sutter Kane, you know, has written into his book. That's like the plot twist. This whole thing has been the progression of Sutter Kane's last book as it takes the world apart.
Yeah.
But what I love is that, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, is that there's nothing we humans can do to escape it. And I think that that's what makes me so happy about this. Because you see a lot of horror movies where you've got these giant concepts and, you know, like these demons, and they can always be stopped by a magic book or like a chant you say backwards. And in this case, it's like there's no hope. They are actually all powerful. Yeah.
It's fun when you realize that, like, this has all been John Trent, the horror character, written in, and his visage, Sam Neill's face, is painted in that 1950s pulp way on the sides of the bookstores and on the marquee for the movie theater. It looks great. It looks fantastic. Go ahead, Jordan.
I was curious, and I just looked up what other movies were out around the time, and the same time that In the Mouth of Madness was in theaters, Boys on the Side also came out.
I don't know
with Drew
is.
Barrymore. That made $23 million.
Jesus.
And only making $1 million less than In the Mouth of Madness was the Jerky Boys movie.
Oh, that's underappreciated.
which I saw in theaters as like a, whatever, a 9 or 10 year old.
Yeah, I remember trying to rent that from Blockbuster and failing. Wow, and I'm going to guess that Jerky Boys movie cost $50 to make.
And a week later, Billy Madison was in theaters.
Really?
And history was written there.
Oh, God.
And that made $25 million.
I wonder how much that movie has made in residuals, because that has to be like... Yeah, that's got to be more than the GDP of several countries by now.
It's a beloved movie.
Yep.
That's the biggest proof that capitalism isn't working, that Billy Madison can make more money than the GDP of several countries.
Well, it is a very good
that's
movie.
That's just a joke. There are a lot of other signs, folks. Yeah.
So, yeah. No, it's great, though, because Sam Neill is, you know, we're revisited where we were at the very beginning of the movie with him in his padded cell. I believe that it's called starting the movie In Medias Res, if I recall, 7th grade English. And the, you know, psychologist is asking him, like, you know, you want to leave or something? He's like, no, it's safer in here. He's like, well, what about all the people that don't read books? You know, will they be fine?
Books.
Yeah, books. I think you're better than me. What about all these people that don't read? Like, won't that be fine? Because not that many people read. He's like, there's a movie coming out.
And that movie's name? Corky Romano.
Well, what's so... I didn't catch this first detail, you know, the first 2 or 3 times I saw this, but when he finally gets out of the asylum because it's been torn apart by monsters, he's walking through a city street and he sees the movie poster up on a theater, and of course it's his face, but then all of the movie details, like the stars and the cast, are who worked on the reel In the Mouth of Madness. So just like driving home that extra detail.
Yeah. We close the movie with Sam Neill in his hospital gown, going and grabbing a bucket of popcorn, sitting down in an abandoned theater, and watching himself, what we've just watched for the last 90 minutes, his fuck-ups and foibles and getting mm-hmm. owned by demons. And he just gives the most insane laugh all throughout it. It's really a delightful...
Which just... Well, the laugh that turns into sobbing.
Yeah.
Because he's realized, like, he's not a real human. He has just been constructed for this purpose.
Or he died and this is purgatory.
Right.
Or, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'd love if there was just, like, a random crossover where, like, he comes down the hospital driveway. You know, there's blood everywhere. Cars are overturned. And just meets, like, Alice from the Resident Evil series, like, also in a hospital gown. Just, wait, what are we doing? but no, it's, God, it's just so good. And it ends on this note of hopelessness, but he sells it so well that, I don't know, I was kind of shook.
That Sam Neill is so damn likable. It's also, the movie begins and ends with this instrumental score that Carpenter wrote that is a pretty shameless ripoff of Enter the Sandman. I don't know if you... Do you remember listening to that, Jordan?
No, I don't.
We'll play it on the show.
Well, you could also play, and in a reference to the movie, there is a rapper who goes by the name Sutter Kane.
Yes.
I saw that.
And he also briefly went by the name Rabbi Kane, which is why I know him, because what the hell?
That's awesome. Yeah, when I was looking up Sutter Kane, I think on, like, Wikipedia, it was like, did you want this Sutter Kane?
No.
Or the rapper Sutter Kane? So, yeah, I just saw that, too.
His music ranges from East Coast hip-hop to ghetto metal.
Mm. I'm so fascinated.
It's new metal, then. rap rock, rather. Horrorcore. Overall, I'm going to give this movie I'm going to give it an 8.8.
I'm going to give it a 9.5. I think this might be my favorite Carpenter movie, honestly.
Wow.
That's a real close tie between this and The Thing.
Yeah, that's a pretty bold claim there.
I don't know if it's Carpenter or Sam Neill my love is hinging on, but it's either way, like, they're pretty close.
What's your overall take, Jordo?
Maybe between 7.5 and 8. You know, very enjoyable, very good. I think probably with a bigger budget, it could have been even better.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, nowadays, if they made it with a bigger budget, I think they would have screwed it up.
Oh,
too
it
much
would be
CGI.
And awful.
Yeah.
All that, yeah. But I think back then, if it had a little bit more money and a little bit more oomph to it, it could have been even better.
I think I might be really generous just because I recently watched, well, this past week, I watched Carpenter's Body Bags. And was so put off by that. I mean, it's okay, but it's not his best work by far. That seeing this, I was like, oh, you are good. Like, you do have amazing work.
He's made a lot of movies.
Yeah.
And as I always say when we finish a show, they can't all be winners.
Accurate. There are just a few off the bat that I'm thinking of. Like, you know, Vampires Los Muertos. And I think he did Ghosts of Mars.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
As a friend of mine once described Ghost of Mars, Ice Cube goes to Mars and fucks up Guar.
Which, objectively, sounds like a great time. And it's really, I mean, it's not as bad as I'm making it out to be. But, yeah, definitely not his finest work.
Well, I figure before we end this show, we can go ahead and go back around, do that thing we normally do at the beginning. We're going to talk about some music. Is that all right with you?
I mean, we might as well now that we're, 40 minutes into the show?
Yep. Britt and I have been mostly incommunicado this weekend because we got ourselves some free tickets to Austin City Limits Festival, which is very nice because this is a thing I would never pay for. Tickets are like $250 for...
No, they're more than that.
What?
They're like $275, $325.
Jesus
at the
Christ.
Low end, like the general admission.
Yeah. We got free VIP passes, which means that we get to use nice bathrooms and drink free beer. So that's kind of like what I was into it for because the fare at ACL Fest is a little off from what I would normally consume. But there were a couple of things that we had to check out over the time.
I think what I love so much about having these passes is how quickly Joe became a classist and walks, you know, through the VIP entrance line and yells suckers at, like, the kids waiting in line at general admission.
You can't blow up my spot here.
All right. I'll keep it to myself.
But yes, given just a tiny grain of power, I let it go all to my head.
Just a tiny grain of power and free Coors, and he's a totally different man.
You're going to be the guy in the zombie apocalypse movie that, like, runs into the safe room and closes the door behind him, locking out the other characters.
Yep. The guy that's from the Dawn of the Dead remake.
The guy wearing the suit the whole time?
Yeah, the guy that became, like...
Who's in Modern Family.
Modern Family guy.
Oh, my God, yes. Phil.
Yeah. Oh, that guy's such a good dick in that movie.
Which is so fun because he's such a great dad in Modern Family. Like, he's got range. But yeah, so we've been doing that all weekend.
We checked out a band that I know several listeners are familiar with. I don't know. They had a kind of a career, I guess, at some point. Guns N' Roses. Have you ever heard of those guys?
Sounds familiar. They were one of those thrash bands, right?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Most famous for having a guitarist, Tracy Guns, in the band. It's they got a 3-hour set on the first night. So we were over by the media tent, and I heard like some guitar noodling, and I was like, "It sounds like a Guitar Center over there." And I realized that was Guns N' Roses.
There's no one I want to see for 3 hours.
You know, we sat through 2 out of 2.5 hours of The Cure last night, and I would have stuck around for the last 30 minutes if I didn't think it would be the vampire apocalypse trying to get a bus ride home afterwards. The Cure were excellent, though. Oh, my God.
His voice was just, I mean, unchanged, you know, just perfect. And seeing Guns N' Roses Friday and then seeing a, I guess, similarly aged band Saturday night. Yeah. Oh, my God. The difference in just quality was so pronounced.
Axl's voice is fucking shot. I know a lot of people have seen their reunion shows and said that they sound great. You're lying to yourself, dude. That was rough.
Like Vince Neil rough?
It was approaching that. By the time, I'd say about an hour into their set, he was gassed.
Yeah. Well, and that night, Friday night after we saw them, the shuttle we took back to downtown to get our car, we ended up next to this older couple. We were asking who they were there to see, and the man, I felt so bad for him because he was like, you know, I really wanted to see Guns N' Roses, and I got through like 10 minutes, and then I just needed to leave.
Yeah.
Wow.
Behold the horror of age. But no, it was very awkward seeing, you know, men in their 50s and approaching 60s, like wearing the same shit that they were wearing when they were like 20 and doing songs about being cool and shit, and just fat and old and sad and not really able to move very well. And then you saw The Cure, which is similar fat old men, but, you know, I guess it works a little bit better because all their songs were about feeling old and sad.
Was anyone in the crowd wearing a Slash top hat?
No.
If only.
Yeah, I can't believe that. I didn't see a single top hat all day. I gotta tell you, man, the fashion at this shit is absurd. People put themselves into the most uncomfortable shit to stand in 98 degree weather all fucking day.
I have to say, like, one of the highlights of the weekend for me, we saw Billie Eilish, and just watching Joe look around in, like, confused irritation at all the, like, children around wearing thongs, and then just saying over and over, "What's a Billie Eilish?" That was probably the highlight for me.
Billie Eilish went on at 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. and had a crowd probably about the same as any of the headliners from the entire weekend. I would say at least 50,000 people were out there watching her. This girl who is 17, I don't know if she has a full album yet out or not. I don't know how you, like, is she played on the radio, or, like, how do people?
Yeah, okay. She's played on the radio. She's, I mean, extremely popular among younger people, but also just, like, her influence is growing. She's the Sutter Kane of young spooky girl pop, yeah, if you can believe that.
Her thing is she's a young pop star, but she's spooky, and she dresses like a new metal fan at a Kmart.
No, I'd say she dresses like a teenage girl at, like, a Staten Island carnival.
Circa, like, 1999. Yes. You need to clarify this.
Circa 1999. So, like, lots of oversized outfits, lots of neon, which she's been really upfront about. Like, number one, she just doesn't give a fuck. Like, she's young, she's got money. But she also doesn't feel the need to sexualize herself like a lot of other female artists may at this point.
Sure, but, I mean, there's no reason to, because you've been so fucking successful, and this made me, like, really, I was just standing there feeling old as shit and grumpy as hell, and I was like, are all of you people here just because you heard that this person is famous and you want to see this famous person?
We're
here
because she's a spooky bitch, Joe.
I don't get it, man. Is your significant other into Billie Eilish?
No.
Okay. I think that it's an age thing. I'll never understand this one.
Oh, well, you know, like we said offline, give it a year, give it 2 years, people be like, who? Oh, yeah. Because that's what happens for the majority of pop stars nowadays. I would say if she does try to start the little sexualization, wearing tighter clothes, whatever you want to call it, that's when you know album sales aren't as good for her anymore.
Yeah.
Ooh. I guess what would be the male side of that?
Show and dong.
Ooh!
Or, well, it would be, what's that picture going around right now on Twitter of, was it Garth Brooks and his, like, Chris Evans?
Chris Gaines.
Chris Gaines, yeah, not Chris Evans.
I was his like, little, Chris Evans.
Well, yeah.
His soul patch.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, I think that was actually the last record that Garth Brooks put out back in fucking 2001, I guess. Like, legitimately, aside from greatest hits albums, I think that was it. So he, I would say he killed his career, but every time he plays a show, he sells it out. An insane person. Me and Chris went and saw him in Houston. He is an insane person. If he's not, like, fully gacked out 24/7 on cocaine, he is just genuinely unbalanced.
See, the Bam Margera of, like, country.
You're not wrong. You're not
Instead
wrong.
Of inviting people to his mansion to, like, be in the hot tub and skateboard, he's just like, you want to come shoot guns and ride my gators around?
Yeah, pretty much.
Gator here being the car, for any listeners not familiar with that term, or the four-wheeler versus, like, an alligator.
I'm positive that he's rich enough that he has trained gators that you just can ride on.
With saddles.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Made of gator skin because he's a fucked up dude.
Ooh. Ooh. Made of crocodile skin so the gators feel good.
Oh my nice. God. Yeah.
Fuck them gators.
I was just like.
Shit. Best last words ever heard in my life, man.
Fuck them gators.
So we're gonna go back to ACL when we're done recording here.
Mm-hmm.
Who are we seeing tonight?
We're seeing Lizzo, Kacey Musgraves, Cardi B is playing, but I mm-hmm. don't know if we'll be seeing her. And then there was somebody else that was recommended, but I cannot remember who. But yeah, those are the trifecta, as you could call it, of this winding down hot girl summer. Kacey Musgraves, Lizzo, and then Cardi B.
So all of those musical acts that people that listen to our show genuinely love.
I'm ready for Sad Boy Fall at this point.
Fucking A, dude.
Just crank up the typo negative.
Yeah.
So, like, it's been approaching 100 degrees, like, almost every day here, but we got the cold front coming in tonight, and I am going to wear death metal long sleeves until it's 100 degrees again.
So a day?
Yeah, pretty much. I narrowly avoided pre-ordering the new Blood Incantation long sleeve shirt because I was just like, I'll just be disappointed to see it in my closet and not be able to wear it.
Mm-hmm.
Kid's a glutton for punishment. He'll wear it every day anyway.
He's a glutton for looking cool. Shouts out to you, Kit.
I figure we ought to give a heads up. We're going to come back with the next episode. We're going to cover another movie because it's still fucking October and we're still spooky. The next one is You're Next, and I love that movie. Go watch it. It is on some streaming platform or another right now. You will kick yourself in the ass if you miss it, because then you can't join us for conversation next week.
I will not be on that one, but man, I gotta second that. You're Next is this genuinely, like, surprising piece where it doesn't feel exploitative, like movies with a similar message often do. So yeah, cannot recommend it enough. But while we're here, we've talked about the music that no one cares about.
Uh-huh.
Jordan, is there any music or metal news that people would care about?
Slayer sold $10 million worth of merchandise on their current 3-year farewell tour.
Jesus Christ.
So I've seen the prices at the merch booth. That must be like 100 shirts.
Are they like $50, $60 tour t-shirts?
Yes, they legitimately are.
Like, I hate that.
Yeah.
I don't understand how bands are able to get away with that now.
One of my favorite images that was going around a few years back was somebody snapped a picture of the merch booth at a Macklemore show.
Oh, no.
His t-shirts were $40. That was his fucking line in his song. Like, yo, that's $40 for a t-shirt.
Nickel Macklemore.
Oh. Oh my god.
Got his ass! Ugh! So
that's not an original. That's ICP said that, so
oh,
credit okay. to them. That's still pretty good,
though. The poets of our day.
Getting more right.
So yeah, like so $10 million worth of Farewell to Your t-shirts. I wonder if like Aerosmith pulled that same number when they pulled the same scam in like 94.
They probably couldn't charge as much, but I can understand the appeal of, well, this is the last time I'm going to see them play Toledo. I have to get a shirt because it says Toledo on it. Here is my $50. And that's probably everywhere. Like, I don't think they do it. I know Hatebreed does now, at least on their current tour, where they make a specific shirt for the specific town they're playing in.
I think that's actually pretty fucking tight.
Yeah.
Like, I saw the Iron Maiden shirts that they had for their most recent run in Texas. Is like, Eddie, like, with a flamethrower in the desert and rattlesnakes everywhere. I'm like, okay, that's fucking tight.
And there was an article on Blabbermouth with the headline, "How much did publicity generated by Kendall Jenner wearing Slayer t-shirt affect band's merchandise haul?" And it's just like, don't make me defend Slayer. Come on.
Seriously.
That did nothing. Stop it.
You assholes, quit trying to link to your own content. I know how the SEO game works, you dickheads. That's a lie. I don't know how it works. Otherwise, we'd be much more successful. Please help us. What do you think? Because I'm coming around on this now, like with that number, this could legitimately be like a play to just put enough in the bank to never have to do this again, because Tom looks tired, dude.
But this is all the more reason to keep doing it.
That's true.
It's never enough. It's never enough, especially with these aging metal bands. Like, how many farewell tours or little gimmicks are they doing? Metallica's doing SMN2 again. Like, they're doing theater shows. Slayer now has their stupid movie in movie theaters. It's not going to end.
No.
Maybe they won't do a big world tour. Maybe they won't even do a big North American tour. But they're not going to go away.
You just reminded me of something when you mentioned Metallica. So every year at Austin City Limits, there's something called Austin Kitty Limits, just talking about like people not knowing when to go away or stop. And Austin Kitty Limits is meant for children. Like, you know, it's a little area tucked away from the fest where kids can go watch acts. And
Rob Trujillo's 12-year-old son has
a kid's band.
A kid's metal band. And apparently, Rob will sometimes join them on stage. So security has to get out in front of the kitty entry area to kick out old metal dudes who don't have children with them so that they can go stare at the third bass player for Metallica.
Who's playing a kid's show with
I'm sorry, the fourth bass player. I forgot Ron McGovney, so sorry about that.
Rob, sign my Gibson.
Yeah, didn't mean to detract from this the idea that these guys will never give up, but that just reminded me of other guys who will also never give up.
Yeah. Rob, come to my dental practice. I'll give you 10% off.
I guess I just think to myself all the time, like, how much money do I need to never work again? Because that's a thing that I would like to do, to not work. Surely, you know, everybody in Metallica, everybody in Slayer, they've got enough money to quit working forever. You know, they probably live a pretty lavish lifestyle afterwards, too. Why do you keep doing it?
Because it's all they know. And if you look at, like, some of their non-music projects, James Hetfield narrating that anti-porn documentary.
Oh, my God, I forgot about that one.
What else are they going to do? And if they do other things, they almost always fail. Like, unless they just lend their name to someone else to make Robert Trujillo coffee, then they just got to keep playing.
Can't you just, like, take up fishing or, like, woodworking, do nothing, watch TV? I mean, these are all valid options.
You get bored.
I don't know. I've never had that problem. I have an Nintendo Switch.
Nothing compares to the sweet thrill of being on stage, sweating, you know, buckets, feeling your heart flutter in your chest as it vainly tries to continue on with this life that you've given it.
Butchering pop songs on stage in front of millions of people.
Yeah. They're really addicted to the glazed over, like, slight resentment that they see in the eyes of their fans who realize their best days have passed.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That's my opinion on it.
Same. I don't know how we can top that. Is there anything else that you want to tack on here?
No, I think that's a good place to end on. Just a series of down notes.
It's the way we do it.
Well, I have one recommendation before we leave. Watch Your Next. But I also caught a movie that kind of blew my mind this past week on Shudder. And so if you haven't seen it, Jordan, I also highly recommend it. It's called Vampire Circus. It's a 70s erotic vampire movie that somehow also works in a Hungarian or Serbian circus into the mix, along with a curse. So it sounds wild, but yeah, I think that if I have to recommend something aside from, like, in addition to Your Next, if you want something really weird and off the map, that's a great one.
There you have it, folks. Watch that instead of the damn Joker.
No, watch the Joker too, because apparently it's not half bad.
We'll just see about that.
Okay.
Yeah, man. Thanks for joining us, everybody, for this family episode of the Toilet Pal Radio Show. And sorry if we didn't do enough Crypt Keeper voices on this one. We'll work harder on it next time. Love you. Bye.
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 listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.